This is The Takeaway. Yes, this is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And Vince, can we play that disaster, the Trump stuff again here?
It's a total disaster.
The Iran deal is a disaster. It's a disaster.
It is a disaster.
Disaster.
He's been using that word as he describes the state of the nation. Hyperbole, perhaps. Perhaps not. Disaster. Disaster. This hour. Disasters large and small. Here's a fiscal state of disaster we'll be talking about later this hour in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. But some designers are trying to find a quality of life and some real solutions to poor residents of Rio de Janeiro. We will give you a taste of a disastrous little jingle for the Trump campaign offered up by some very earnest little girls in Florida, all as a way of talking about the American tradition of product jingles. And there is a real disaster in the Trump political bank account. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But first, is this something like what you see on fire alarms? In case of fire, break glass? Here, in case of campaign disaster, is Speaker Paul Ryan telling GOP convention delegates quietly, read between the lines here, to break the glass and vote their consciences? He kind of made it clear on Meet the Press on Sunday that he wouldn't be standing in the way of anyone's crisis of conscience about Donald Trump or anyone else.
The last thing I would do is tell anybody to do something that's contrary to their conscience. So it is not my job to tell delegates what to do, what not to do, or to weigh in on things like that. They write the rules. They make their decisions. All I want to make sure is it's done above board, clearly, honestly, and by the rules.
By the rules, above board, and indeed rules for the GOP convention would have to be changed for delegates to vote anything other than what they're pledged to do, but could happen. With me now to discuss the strategy of the Vote Your Conscience initiative is Regina Thompson, a Republican delegate in Colorado, and one of the co-founders of Free the Delegates. Welcome, Regina.
Thank you for having me.
Free the Delegates. It sounds like, freedom now, freedom now.
Well, you know, everyone needs a jingle.
Do you? Exactly. That's what this hour is about. You should stay with us. So do you feel unfree? Do you want to be able to do something that you're not permitted to do right now?
Well, for myself personally, no. My understanding is that since the first convention of the Republican Party, other than one in 1976, that the delegates have always been free to vote their conscience, and they've had, for the most part, their votes faithfully recorded as cast. Our contention is that that holds true today, that there is nothing within the rules today that precludes delegates from actually voting their conscience. Now, many delegates don't understand that. They're afraid to do it because they've got their state GOPs telling them otherwise. They've got state bylaws that were written differently. But our contention is that they are already free. I feel no bounds myself, but I'm working to help the others understand the same thing.
Now, let's talk about what the enforcement mechanism would be here. You're a delegate from Colorado, right?
Correct.
Who's the head of your delegation?
The head of our delegation is our state party chair, Steve House.
Okay, so Steve House, probably a wonderful fellow. If you were to vote differently from what you're pledged to do, as far as you can tell, the only punishment there is he would give you a very nasty look on camera that everyone would see around the nation, but that your vote would be recorded, and that would have to be the case.
Well, yes, and we in Colorado, that's not an issue for us. Every one of our delegates here were elected from a Cruz slate, and every delegate, in order to be on that slate, pledged to the campaign itself that they would vote for Senator Cruz on every ballot until the campaign told them otherwise. So for us in Colorado, they're bound to, by honor, to vote for a candidate, in order to be on the slate. Now, if any one of them chooses to vote for another candidate on the first, on the first ballot, then I would, honor that as their right to do so. But I personally, I would, have a talk with them about honor in pledging to do something else to the campaign and then, voting otherwise. But there's no retribution in Colorado that could be done to those folks.
What about other states?
Well, in other states, there are some states, such as North Carolina, has forced their delegates to sign a pledge that tells them that if they basically dishonor their pledge or embarrass the Republican Party, that they could be barred from participating in the party for up to 10 years. They could face a $10,000 fine and have their credentials pulled at the convention. And so for those delegates, who are wanting to vote their conscience, this is, that's very, very heavy-handed threats against them. I'm not sure what will happen. There's a lot of them looking at various options. They're talking to attorneys to find out if this is really something legitimate, because it's threatening for them. That's a lot of money and a lot of time to be barred from participation.
Could you get a majority of the Rules Committee to say, look, whatever you want to vote, that's fine. We'll deal with it on the floor?
Well, that's what one of my colleagues here in Colorado, who's on the Rules Committee, she is introducing a conscience clause. If it gets out of the Rules Committee, and then that's her task, is, you know, talking to other delegates that are on the Rules Committee to get that passed, and then it would go to the convention floor. Our thought is that particular clause, although we still think we're unbound, that would give those delegates who are afraid, who don't believe it, or who just want something solid and writing, you know, once that passes, then they can say to their delegation, you know, see, I really have permission to vote my conscience. And that's the purpose of that clause. It's to give that permission slip to those doubting and fearful delegates.
How many, before we go, in just a couple seconds, how many delegates do you think would actually vote their conscience if you could put them down on a piece of paper and say, here, look, so, this is how many I have,
I think that when we get there, other than those that are already free to vote for a candidate other than Mr. Trump, I think we're going to see 300 or 400 that will take that step and actually vote their conscience.
Regina Thompson is a Republican Colorado delegate and co-founder of Free the Delegates. Thank you, Regina.
Thank you.
Lord have mercy. Lord have mercy, if you please.
Monday night was the monthly Federal Election Commission deadline for presidential campaigns to report their finances, and the news from Donald Trump is a disaster. Unless your issue is getting money out of presidential politics, money, basically, Trump has none. $2 million in cash on hand compared to Hillary Clinton's $30 million in April, and now that has shrunk to only $1.3 million on the Trump side. And even now that Trump has joined forces with the RNC to raise money, he faces a huge goal, $1 billion, that Republican donors may or may not come forward with. And speaking at a rally over the weekend, Trump, of course, says Plan A is still Plan A.
Otherwise, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. I'll just keep funding my own campaign. I'm okay with that. That's the easy way. I mean, for me, that's the easy way.
But there are major questions about whether he has the cash right now to do even close to that. Rebecca Ballhouse is a Wall Street Journal reporter covering politics and campaign finance. What does this look like now?
I think for now, what it reflects more than anything is just the pace at which Trump has set up a finance organization for himself. And he really took his time in May after he became the presumptive nominee. He said he was not going to self-fund his general election campaign. But he didn't really rush to assemble a finance team. He appointed a finance chairman. He made this joint fundraising deal with the RNC about halfway through the month. But it didn't really get off the ground. So, I mean, he's been holding a lot more fundraisers in June. We'll have to see how well those did. He spoke at a rally last weekend and said that he thought his fundraising tour through Texas last week raised about $13 or $15 million. But the fundraising strategy that he's pursuing is also one that just isn't going to raise that much money for his campaign.
All right. So there's some that we don't know here. But if we just sort of take these numbers as square one, what's the uphill here?
$1 billion is really the number that's most often talked about for what you need to raise for a general election campaign. He said in interviews also $500 million would be the number that he would be looking for. And of course, his campaign has also said that Trump is an unconventional candidate and that he may not need to raise as much money as other presidential candidates have had to. So it may be true that he needs less money than some candidates because of his public relations strategy. But at the same time, if he's going up against Hillary Clinton, who's raised about $240 million for her campaign and also has a super PAC that's raised about $87 million, he's just going to need to raise a sizable chunk of money if he wants to run TV ads, if he wants to have a grassroots operation in these battleground states. He said he wants to expand the map for Republicans, and there's no way to do that without raising money.
What if he's right? I mean, is it possible that he is right, that that kind of traditional money and traditional fundraising doesn't guarantee anything, and you only need to point to, you know, Jeb Bush, whose donors, you know, dumped $130 million into the incinerator?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there is certainly some truth to it. And I think what Jeb Bush really showed was the lack of effectiveness of outside money, so super PAC specifically, because, as you say, he had this $100 million super PAC that really wasn't able to do anything. But I think that you do need to have money in your campaign, because you need to be able to pay staffers and have a ground game operation. And I think you really need to be in these battleground states where you're going to be rivaling her campaign, which has had staffers on the ground for months. You need to be able to actually employ people.
We've observed this throughout the campaign, this cycle of Trump says one thing and the media or someone else says, no, actually, the emperor has no clothes. There's, you know, not the business expertise. There's not the political support. There's, you know, in this case, there's not any financing. And then Trump, you know, doubles down and says, yeah, we're naked. That's our strategy. I mean, how striking is the contrast between these realities that you see in these numbers and what you feel and see at these rallies?
I mean, he's certainly always very upbeat at the rallies. You've seen him try and sort of dance around the issue of polling in the last couple rallies, I would say, because polls have showed that Hillary Clinton is starting to lead him by a larger and larger gap. And so he's sort of not really said that in rallies, but has said, we'll catch up. And he certainly sounds very positive at these rallies. But I think when you talk to a lot of fundraisers, what they say is that at the rallies, he's really still addressing his primary audience. And they're worried that they feel like a lot of the people who go to these rallies are the same people going over and over again, and that he's not taking the pains to address a general election audience and to try and bring in new supporters. And I think that's what you see happening with these fundraising numbers. He's raised about $14 million in addition to his personal loans, and he seems to be struggling to find new donors to come help his effort.
Rebecca Ballhaus is a Wall Street Journal reporter covering politics and campaign financing. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Got a favorite jingle, you know, advertising jingle?
Hello, this is Anne Marie from the Philadelphia suburbs. I think a lot of you will remember this. If you've got a passion for fashion, and you've got a craving for saving, take the wheel of your automobile and swing on down to Ideal.
Mobile, Alabama. My baloney has a first name, Oscar Mayer, and plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Alka-Seltzer, of course.
Alka-Seltzer, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is.
Concord, California, several favorites that may date me. If you think it's butter, but it's not, it's chiffon, that's right. And how about meow, 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 meow. Later this hour, we're going to bring the jingle back. Companies spending millions on catchy tunes that they want to stick in your head. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll unstick you. Comment at thetakeaway.org. In a bit of very expensive global political theater, NATO went to great lengths this month to show that it means business and would stand against Russia if Vladimir Putin launched an invasion into a country besides already war-torn Ukraine or occupied and annexed Crimea. Do the Baltics feel safe? Or Poland, which is right at the center of all this? NATO's training exercise, Operation Anaconda 16, more than 31,000 troops from 24 nations simulating what would happen in a Russian attack on Poland. Putin downplayed the whole thing last weekend, saying that NATO is only trying to justify its existence with these war games.
What they need is an external enemy. Otherwise, no one would think why this organization is needed. There is no more Warsaw Pact, neither the USSR. Why would they need it? If we stick to this very logic, the scaremongering, that's probably the way to a Cold War. Our logic is of a different aim at finding compromises and negotiations and cooperation.
Russian President Vladimir Putin speaking to CNN's Fareed Zakaria at a panel discussion in St. Petersburg over the weekend. Other Russian officials this week and last have angrily denounced the banning of the Russian track and field team from participating in the upcoming Summer Olympics in Rio. It's the first time in history an entire team has been banned from participation because of doping. Russian officials said this was another sign of the West treating Russia unfairly. Kimberly Martin is professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Kimberly, professor, welcome.
Thank you, John.
Let's just talk generally. What's the Russian reaction, the Putin reaction to the the ban, the war games, just this whole sense as the summer begins?
Well, you know, it's really kind of amusing because, of course, Putin is the one who needs an external enemy to keep his internal regime in power. Nobody would tolerate his authoritarianism if they didn't think that there was an external enemy that they had to fight against. And in terms of saying that the Olympic ban has anything to do with the West, these are global organizations. They're not Western organizations. And also, there have been Western teams that have been affected by the rulings that have come out from these groups.
So can the Russians really say never mind about the Olympics and not suffer some sort of domestic problem once there's no Russian flag on the podium?
It's really going to be a dilemma for Putin because his primary goal is to make Russia a great power again. And obviously, the Soviet Union always did so well in the Olympics. It was sort of part of how the Soviet Union portrayed its glory internationally. And now to have that fall apart because of accusations of corruption that touch very closely to the top of his regime, including him himself, it's an embarrassment. And so he's going to have a hard time figuring out this one.
Some members of the EU have warned that it may be scaremongering, in the words of Vladimir Putin, to pursue an aggressive NATO policy on the border with Russia. Here's German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier warning that saber-rattling and war crimes directed at Russia is wrong, and anyone who believes that symbolic tank parades on the alliance's eastern border will increase security is wrong. Is that a widely held view within the EU, and is that something that the Obama administration and NATO is likely to take to heart?
Well, I think there's some countries in the EU that are split, and Germany is one of them. But there is a very strong sense among an important group of German leaders that Russia really violated the entire understanding of what the post-Cold War order was supposed to be like when it unilaterally invaded Crimea, because borders were not supposed to be changed that way. And so Germany is one of the places where we're seeing that kind of disagreement come to the forefront. But I think it's too early to say that the people who are more cooperative in orientation towards Russia are the ones who are going to come out on top. Certainly, Putin is very happy to see any kind of dissension that is possible within NATO. He would like to see NATO fall apart. And so that certainly is something that he welcomes.
So let's make you the president of Latvia. How safe are you feeling right now after these war games?
You know, I don't think it's the war games themselves that make a difference. It's the fact that NATO is paying attention to the Baltics and to Poland and saying we haven't forgotten you and we are not going to desert you. Because a year or two ago, everybody was saying, oh, it would never be in U.S. interest to actually come to the defense of the Baltics. And so we should just maybe leave the Baltics to hang out to dry. It was a mistake to let them into NATO to start with.
Is that what this war games did in kind of a way? Because if they'd done a war game simulating an invasion of Estonia or something, that would have been much more provocative than Poland. Does anyone really expect that Poland would be a target?
Well, it depends what you mean by target. I don't think anybody is actually expecting that it is in Russia's interest to have a land-based typical military invasion of any NATO country. So the question is whether they would try to somehow disrupt something at a political level, create a situation of tension and riots.
With Russian speakers inside the Baltics, for instance.
Yes, exactly. And what Putin is really good at doing is surprising people, at pulling things out of a hat that nobody was expecting. And so I don't think that this shows that we are ready to take on anything that Putin might come up with. Instead, it shows that we are paying attention to what Putin is doing and that the Baltics are part of the NATO alliance that are still very important and that nobody is ignoring them.
Okay, so the rabbit Putin pulls out of the hat this week is something to manipulate the vote on Brexit. Do you think he's pro or anti Brexit?
Well, I think he would be interested in anything that causes the European Union to fall apart. And so he's also been demonstrated that he is funding or supporting nationalist political parties throughout Europe. And so it would be very much in his interest to see any kind of disruption in the Western economy, any kind of disruption in the European Union. I'm sure he'd be happy if Brexit succeeds.
So that's a leave vote there. So Finally, has he bought time with oil prices stabilized at this higher level?
It's very interesting that what Putin and his team have done is allowed the ruble to fall. And so as a result, they have actually continued to make money even with lower oil prices because, of course, when the ruble falls with the dollar and oil is traded in dollars, it still means that there are rubles coming into the economy. And so he's played that one very well.
Never bet against the brain of an oligarch, I guess.
Well,
the rule there.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But the other thing to keep in mind is that the real problem with the Russian economy is that it hasn't been decentralized. It hasn't been privatized. It is still being run in a very inefficient way with lots of corruption.
Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me back, John.
The upcoming Olympic Games, about 7 weeks away, represent a global challenge for design, architecture, and global cooperation. In addition to all the athletes, the influx of athletes and spectators demands upgraded public works, from the water and medical systems challenged by Zika virus to the roads and transportation systems serving 12 million residents in the Rio metro area. The creation of a glitzy Olympic paradise in the middle of Rio de Janeiro, a city with some of the world's most wretched poverty and famous slums or favelas, would only exacerbate Brazil's political instability. So Harvard-educated Pedro Henrique de Cristo, along with his wife and partner Caroline Shannon, founders of Plus D Design with Purpose, became part of an effort to show that along with the Olympics, design can deliver effective solutions to underserved communities. De Cristo, who spoke with us, helped transform Park City, a former 16-ton garbage dump, into a landmark urban park and center of pride for the Vidigal favela community that owns and operates it.
I consider myself, most of all, an interdisciplinary designer, in which my main scale, my background is architecture. But at all the times, what I feel like is an instrument to serve the people and to serve the city. And it's very tough because you have to make serious sacrifices in terms of finances, in terms of like even sometimes put yourself at dangerous situations when you're learning the context and so on. But I'm doing what I believe and what I love. And what's interesting about architecture is that it has become more irrelevant than ever, but it's more relevant to solve the problems than any time.
Where did you learn to listen? At what point in the favela did you realize you had to listen and take something in, and what came out?
It was a process, you know, and I think I'm still learning to listen better to people, because when you're really obsessed about the work you do and have a lot of purpose, sometimes you can see if the work has to be done ahead of the people. But we all are driven by our perceptions, and our perceptions don't mean they're the truth. I realized that it was very arrogant that governments and like designers would go to cities and propose things like people that were patients. And to have the most important thing, which is a cultural transformation, you need to have the people that are going to be the object of the cultural transformation as the owners of the change, the leaders of the change.
Describe a choice that the community made for the park space that no architect would ever have made and might have provoked an argument, but for the fact that community first.
One brilliant thing that the community realized was that, look, if we just take the trash out and bring it up, people keep throwing it here, you know. So they brought new soil and they start planting urban agriculture. And what happens is that people stop throwing trash there because they were getting lettuce, they were getting tomatoes, they were getting...
somebody's garden.
Exactly. Yeah.
When the Olympics comes to Rio, it's not likely that these communities will be showcased. But in many ways, they may be a more important story than what goes on in the Olympics and Brazil's attempts to hold itself together for the Games. What do you think?
I totally agree with you. I think the main reason we decided to go for the Olympics was because of its legacy to the city of Rio and to the country, right? And the big problem right now is a lot of the legacy projects have been delayed. Their quality of construction is very low. And we had this huge hope with the peacemaking police units. And when we realized that just the police was there for a long time and we had no investments in social services, in the space of the communities, in the economics, employment, income, then you have no integration. And now everybody's afraid of what's going to happen, because if you look at the other favelas, the levels of violence are rising back to like the beginning of the 2000s. And we are very afraid we're going to get back to the scenario of the 90s. And with the fact that the economy in the whole country is having both conjunctural and structural problems as it is, it's really a situation that we have to be aware that can go a lot worse before it gets better. And if you don't take responsibility for our problems, they're never going to get solved. Otherwise, we're going to have more segregation, more empty houses owned by billionaires, and people are going to be pushed out. And then we're going to have cities that are not for its citizens, but to the powers of the market, which is not an evil thing, but has to be tamed.
All right, Pedro, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Pedro Enrique de Cristo is designer and co-founder of Plus D, Design with Purpose. To see photos of de Cristo's work in Brazil, head over to thetakeaway.org. With characteristic Brazilian drama, all of this Olympic construction is taking place while the state of Rio is under a so-called state of financial disaster. One of those delayed legacy projects Pedro Enrique de Cristo spoke about is the expansion of the subway system in Rio de Janeiro. The state-funded plan was for Line 4 to transport hundreds of thousands of fans and athletes from Ipanema Beach to the suburb of Barra de Tijuca, home of the Olympic Park and Village, in less than 15 minutes. But with 7 weeks until the Olympics, all of that is in doubt. Adriana Gomez Licon is a correspondent for the Associated Press in Rio. Adriana, is this going to make it in 7 weeks?
Well, authorities are telling us that it is going to make it. However, there are people who are concerned about safety because there hasn't been enough time for tests, they tell me. Before, they used to tell us that there were going to be 90 days to test this massive system. Now, it's only really going to happen in a matter of days, 15 to 20 days. So auditors and experts are asking for this project to either be halted until they seek international certifications or that they present these tests that they say that they have been running, even though we don't have much information on what they are.
And what would the backup be if they use the alternative system?
The expansion has been done by the state of Rio de Janeiro. The city of Rio de Janeiro has done this bus rapid transit system, has built the special lanes to use them. So their backup plan is to use this bus rapid transit system and a special lane dedicated to, you know, drivers of the teams and athletes and funds. People traveling for the Olympics could use this lane, and other Rio de Janeiro residents would have to go on the others.
And it's not going to be 15 minutes if they have to take that plan B.
No, it won't be. In a good day, it's an hour drive, but in the middle of the week, a rush hour, which it's probably the time when a lot of people are going to be traveling because most competitions happen in the middle of the day. It's more than an hour. It could be up to 2 hours. We've done, you know, certainly that time on that stretch.
What do people say about the new construction and whether it will ever benefit them, given that it's an express? It basically goes past a lot of places where people live.
There are several stops, so it actually does benefit people. It has been in the talks for like 2 decades. People really want this because it would also connect people from Barra da Tijuca to downtown Rio, where a lot of people work. You know, you would go to Ipanema Beach, and then you can get on a different lane and go to downtown and other parts of northern Rio. But now, you know, they're running out of time for the Olympics, and they won't be able to use them during the Olympics. During the Olympics, it's only for people who they call from the Olympic family. So that's people who, you know, ticket holders, athletes, people traveling with them. So it's really not for them until probably later this year, if they're lucky, I guess.
Are people beginning to see in Rio and in Brazil generally that the new construction and the investments in the Olympics, I mean, people aren't going to be able to use stadiums unless they're athletes, and even then it's only for international competition. But the other construction, is it going to merge well into the existing needs of Rio, or will it look a lot like money thrown down the tubes when the Olympics are over and Brazil really awakens to some very serious realities that we've already been experiencing?
Yeah, many people feel that all this spending is a waste of time and a waste of money, a waste of their resources, especially when they are facing budget cuts in education, healthcare in the state of Rio de Janeiro. Teachers are protesting because they are not getting paid. Pension workers are receiving their payments either delayed or in half or 60%. So it's an interesting phenomenon that we're seeing. People are getting angrier and angrier right now as this financial problem becomes worse in the state, at least. But there are infrastructure projects like the subway that actually are beneficial. These other bus rapid transit system are also, they also feel that they are beneficial because they go a lot faster than if you're just going in a normal bus or in a car.
Adriana Gomez Licon is a correspondent for the Associated Press in Rio de Janeiro. Adriana, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, John.
We told you earlier this hour about the dire, even disastrous state of funding in the Donald Trump campaign and the candidates' resolve to soldier on. Now, here's a little bit of fun. Enemies. We found this from some lovely singers called the Freedom Kids in Florida, who wrote a little song for Donald Trump.
President Donald Trump knows how to make America great. Deal from strength or get crushed every time.
It's a disastrous, if earnest, little jingle for the Trump campaign. Didn't hurt the candidate in Florida earlier this year. But in general, it asks the question, do jingles work? I mean, do they actually sell their product?
Eyes with me under the Anheuser-Busch.
Was this the world's first jingle? A song recorded by Anheuser-Busch from 1904. A tune heard in thousands of American households years before commercial radio took root. A century later, and the jingle is just fine. Nationwide last year spent close to $300 million marketing the simple Nationwide is on your side and helping Peyton Manning's career. This summer, Coca-Cola will again try to teach the world to sing, only this time with song lyrics printed on the cans. For his latest Between the Liner Notes podcast, Matthew Billy says the jingle has come full circle, and what was old in the ad world is now new. Matthew Billy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me on.
What works about this?
Well, I think you have to remember back then there was no radio, there was no television. So when Anheuser-Busch commissioned this song to be composed, they knew that it was going to be on a shelf in Sears as a nice piece of sheet music for people to walk by and see. So then, you know, if you can get a star like Billy Murray to sing it, you know, then people are going to go into Sears and start looking for the sheet music. It was a kind of business model that we don't really have anymore.
So is that the first jingle, really?
Well, no, I don't know if it's the first jingle. You know, really, if you look at the history of advertising products and music, they've always been wed together. This is an example of a proto-jingle. When this was composed, the term jingle didn't actually even apply to music yet. It was a term that only applied to a type of poetry. You know, and then later in the 30s, that term was then moved into being used for music.
You really studied this. So that is a paleo jingle.
Yes.
I guess we would call it a paleo jingle.
This one is special because this is the jingle that kicks off the craze. Before this particular jingle, jingles were not on the radio. There was lots of music with lots of products, but it wasn't like this. You know, Pepsi was not the juggernaut that we know now. They were much smaller than Coke, and they were looking for ways of advertising that were cheap. And the president, Walter Mack, he would try things like skywriting the name Pepsi in the clouds. So these two composers come in with a portable gramophone, and they play him this jingle that they compose. And he says, I love it. So he buys it from them for $500, right? He owns the rights to the thing, doesn't have to pay them any royalties. And he goes to radio stations to try to get it aired. And the radio stations look at him like, we're not going to do this. You know, CBS says no. NBC says no, it's too short. We don't sell anything that's less than 5 minutes. So finally, Walter Mack finds a radio station in northern New Jersey that is desperate for cash. And they say, fine, we'll sell you anything. And he starts airing it at this one radio station. And Pepsi sales skyrocket in this one station. So he tries more. Next thing you know, CBS and NBC are coming to him, asking him for the jingle.
I'm Chiquita Banana, and I've come to say bananas have to ripen in a certain way. And when they're flecked with brown and have a golden hue, bananas taste the best and are the best for you.
My mother sang this song to me. And this is a jingle that preceded my birth, but certainly hung around for a long time. And we even hear it today.
Yeah, it's still there. If you go to the Chiquita Banana website, it plays as soon as you open the website.
You're most digestible, my friend. Delicious too, from end to end.
But this one is special because it was so popular. It transcended just being an advertisement. I mean, people wanted to own it. They wanted to own the sheet music. It was so popular that Chiquita had to hire an orchestra and extend the song to a full 3 minutes. And, you know, if you go to eBay today, you can still find sheet music for this song.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow-white
this song is very important because it, other than just being very famous and used in the finale of Mad Men, it also represents the advertising companies recognizing that the youth market and the sound that teenagers were listening to is a great way to advertise a product. And you really don't start to see that until the end of the 60s and the early 70s. And this Coca-Cola jingle called Hilltops is the quintessential example of that.
And it was a battle of the beverages as well.
You're a whole new generation, just dancing through the day. You're grabbing for the magic on the run. You're a whole new generation, you're loving what they do. I put a Pepsi in the motion, but that choice is up to you. Hey, you're the Pepsi generation.
Now, the phrase Pepsi generation preceded Michael Jackson's use of it in this particular jingle, but it represented a whole big campaign of Pepsi trying to associate itself with a sort of millennial tsunami that, you know, is pre-millennial, but it's all about youth.
Yeah, the term was first used in 1961 for a different jingle, but they adapted it for Michael Jackson. And in the 80s, you have a very interesting trend in advertising music where instead of composing a brand new song, you adapt a song that people already know and already have affection for.
And then you have hit songs that become jingles like We Are the Champions of
yes.
Queen. And you've got almost a fusion of artists selling products yearning for those hits.
Absolutely.
Is the jingle gone in the way that we know it because of that?
Well, I think it's in a depression. There are still jingles. Like if you remember the Subway jingle, the freecreditreport.com jingle.
Okay. Why do you – oh, now that's in my brain for the rest of the day.
But I think the jingle is going to have a future, and I think the future is going to be internet advertising. And I think what that means is that the jingle is no longer going to be – have to be 30 seconds to a minute. I think with a YouTube video, it can be a full pop song.
Hey, that's a girl when I was here tonight. Now what happened? Listen, I was on a first date.
Uh-huh.
Everything was going great.
Then what?
Could be something I ate.
What's that?
Back to his place late night, but I couldn't really wait.
Oh, shh.
Then I saw him bending down one bathroom, no escape. Oh. And I knew he could smell that.
So this is the internet jingle.
Yes. And what's remarkable about it is that it's a full-length song. It sounds exactly like a pop song you would hear on the radio. It has a fully fleshed-out music video, and people have watched this thing 13 million times. And that's willingly. It wasn't force-fed to them like on television. They had to click play.
And what is this selling?
It is a product that you spray into the toilet bowl before you use it. And it has an oil that coats your product and makes it so the odors do not escape.
But again, this would be a jingle of the future. A jingle of today. A jingle of now.
I think so.
Matthew Billy, host of the podcast Between the Liner Notes. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Oh, Matthew, what's your favorite jingle? From Greenville, South Carolina, I still love I'm a Pepper. I sing it in the kitchen to my cat sometimes as I pour a tall glass of Diet Dr. Pepper.
I drink Dr. Pepper, don't you see?
Yes. There we go. 8778 My Take is our number. That's all for today. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.